Good morning and welcome to this October 13th panel of the Minnesota Court of Appeals for oral argument this morning. We'll have six cases on our calendar today, five of which we'll be hearing by oral argument. The first case on our calendar this morning is State of Minnesota versus Jones. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please be mindful of those restrictions. You can choose which podium you'd like to use. The center podium does have the clock, but if you have any health concerns at all, you're free to use the microphone that's closest to your table. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of who's making which argument in our audio recording of the proceedings. And with that, counsel for appellant, you have the floor.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Andrew Nelson. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Sylvester Jones. After 21 months in the Hennepin County Jail, three continued trial dates, and a mistrial, Mr. Jones agreed to plead guilty to third-degree criminal sexual conduct. When he appeared for the plea hearing, however, Mr. Jones told the court that he never raped the mother of his child. His attorney, the prosecutor, and the district court completely ignored his assertion of innocence, and moments later, the district court accepted a factual basis constructed by purely leading questions. By asserting his innocence, Mr. Jones effectively denied all of the elements of the third-degree CSC charge, and his later statements during the factual basis did not correct or withdraw that assertion of innocence. He now asks this court to permit him to withdraw an inaccurate guilty plea that the law did not permit the court to accept. Appellant's brief raises essentially two issues challenging the accuracy of this plea. The first is the negating statements prior to the factual basis. The second is the leading factual basis itself. And I'll address each of those in turn. This court has held in State v. Iverson and its progeny that the factual basis for a plea is insufficient when a defendant makes statements that negate the guilt or negate an essential element of that charged offense.
Which element was negated by your client's comment?
Your Honor, my client's comment, just the specific comment was, I was going to fight this case because I am not scared of this case and I never raped my baby's mama. I would argue that that negates all of the elements. It's an assertion of innocence. It negates the venue element. It negates the penetration element. It negates the force element.
I understand some of the argument you're making. I'm not sure I understand how it would negate venue.
Essentially, and Your Honor, perhaps it doesn't negate venue. Maybe I'm casting too wide of a net here. But the assertion of innocence, him saying, I never committed this sexual assault, I would argue would get rid of every element of this offense. It negates all of them. He's saying, I did not commit this crime.
Right, okay. Well, let's put aside venue because I don't think that's really before us or really at issue. I do want to follow up, though. How do we know what he meant by that statement?
How do you mean, Your Honor?
How do we know what he meant when he used the word rape? What conduct was he referring to?
He was referring to the charged offense in this case, that he was charged with forcefully penetrating without consent
right,
the mother.
My question
child.
Is, how not what did he mean, but how do we know, how do we determine what was meant by the words he used?
Your Honor, I would argue that the words speak for themselves, that I don't think there's any interpretation there. I would argue that rape really only has one common understanding among the general public. And by saying, I never raped my baby's mama, he's saying I did not commit the offense I'm charged with.
What is the basis? What would be the basis for us to adopt your view that there is only one common understanding of what rape means to the general public?
So, Your Honor, I don't think this court needs to get that far into the weeds. The point that I'm trying to make is when a person is charged...
Assume that we think we have to get that far into the weeds. What would be the basis for us to adopt your viewpoint that it's just commonly known what rape means, and that's the meaning that we should apply to your client's statement.
So, Your Honor, I would argue that the general public, non-attorneys, would assume that rape means a forceful sexual encounter without consent.
No, I understand that. That's your assertion. But as you know, as a lawyer, not just a member of the public, that there are multiple elements, various forms of rape. The term rape or sexual assault has various methods for an individual to violate the law. So why would we believe that it's just a common understanding, and that understanding was the one that your client was asserting?
So, Judge Ross, I understand your question. I would say at a minimum, this negates at least the lack of consent here. At a minimum, if it's not negating all of the elements of the offense, it's negating the lack of consent. I think we can at least agree that people would understand rape to mean sex without consent.
Are there a variety or different methods, to use Judge Ross's term, of doing something against someone's consent?
Yes, Your Honor, I would say there probably are.
Okay, so then on what basis do we know which of the various types of actions that you can do without someone's consent was referred to in this case?
Well, given that he was charged with third-degree CSC, it was a vaginal penetration, is what was alleged by the state.
I guess I'm focusing more on non-consent or force. And I think you have agreed that there's different types of things someone can do, either a threat of force or there's some other kind of coercion apart from exerting physical force to accomplish whatever the end. Let's say it's an armed robbery or it's any crime that requires force or coercion. There's a variety of conduct that might or might not fit that. So on what basis do we determine what was meant by his statement?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I'm going to be able to give you a satisfactory answer to that question. When Mr. Jones is appearing for a plea hearing to plead guilty to a third-degree criminal sexual conduct charge and tells the court that he never raped the victim in this case, I only can say that speaks for itself. I don't know what basis this court should differentiate common understandings of sexual assault.
Counsel, if I understand the record correctly, your client was asked whether he used force such as punching and hitting against the victim, and he said yes.
Yes.
Then he was asked if, because he used that force, he was able to have sexual intercourse with the victim despite her not consenting to do so, and he said yes.
That's correct.
So doesn't this record suggest that, you know, his understanding of rape is not necessarily consistent with what's required to establish the offense of third-degree sexual conduct, criminal sexual conduct?
No, Your Honor, I would disagree. And the reason why I would disagree, so this factual basis, that's what you're referring to, happened on page 10. This assertion of innocence, or what I'm claiming to be an assertion of innocence, happened on page 9. So seconds before, if this is in real time. This factual basis is established using purely leading questions.
Which is not disallowed.
It is disfavored, and it has been repeatedly discouraged by this court and by the Court of Appeals and by the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure. Essentially, there is a sliding scale for leading questions. I understand there might be a situation where maybe an attorney wants to help their client who's kind of scared to speak in court, and so they ask them a couple leading questions to get them talking. I don't think counsel would disagree with me that there is not a more leading factual basis than this.
So your argument on the first part of this is that the attorneys or the judge should have stepped in to clarify.
Yes.
They didn't do so. Couldn't you see the leading question as an attempt to clarify? You just said it was seconds later. Isn't it appropriate to use a leading question to clarify what someone means when they make a statement of innocence?
So, Your Honor, what we're looking at, I mean, to answer your question, no. What we're looking at here is in cases like Iverson and then Mikulak, its progeny, this court has held if you negate a statement, the only way to essentially unnegate that statement is to correct or withdraw. That's the language that Mikulak uses.
But do those cases specify whether the correction can or can't be done using leading questions?
Those cases do not. That's a position I'm asserting here today, that a court cannot correct essentially what's an error by using another error. And I would argue that leading questions here is an error.
If you were to list all of the appellate decisions in this court and the Supreme Court where a plea has been overturned because of leading questions, how long would that list be, do you suppose?
It would be short. It would be a few cases like Shorter and a few other cases like that.
And why do you suppose that is?
Well, that's because those cases deal with purely just leading questions. That's the only assignment of error in those cases. What I'm arguing to this court is that you can't separate the leading questions here from the assertion of innocence that happened seconds before.
Counsel, my recollection is that the main concern underlying the accuracy requirement is to ensure that a defendant does not plead guilty to an offense more serious than that which he could be convicted at trial.
That's correct.
Why should I have that concern here?
You should have that concern, and I think cases like Raleigh and the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure highlight the reason for that. And that's because when a defendant's asked purely leading questions, they're not actually telling the court what happened. They're not explaining what they did, and that is where that risk comes into play, the risk of pleading guilty to something more serious than what you actually would be convicted of. Here, like I've said, the attorney constructed this factual basis after ignoring their own client's assertion of innocence. Mr. Jones said nothing during his factual basis except for yes. And so in a case where a defendant claims to be innocent and then merely says yes to his attorney's questions, I think that fear exists, that he's pleading guilty to something more serious than he would be convicted of at trial.
You also focus on what took place at the sentencing, the your client's comments. How does that bear on the plea? I mean, it's after the fact. The plea's already been accepted. I'm trying to think how do we factor it in as a matter of procedure in our structuring of the analysis? I guess bottom line is, does it even matter since we're looking at the plea and the acceptance of the plea itself, and this was after the fact?
Judge Ross, I would agree with you 100%. It does not factor into the accuracy issue itself. I think after page 12 of the plea hearing transcript where the court accepts the factual basis and accepts the plea, I think that's kind of the ending point for this accuracy issue. The reason I mentioned the sentencing, the second assertion of innocence at sentencing, where Mr. Jones says, "I told you guys I did not do this to my baby's mom." The reason I bring that up is because I think it's helpful to look at how the court responds to that assertion. As soon as Mr. Jones makes that assertion at sentencing, the court stops the hearing, tells him to meet with his attorney, and actually goes as far as to reschedule the sentencing for a later date. And opposing counsel in their brief argues that not doing that would have been improper. But that reasoning applies, I would say, in full force, if not even more, to the plea hearing.
What do we make of the fact that even though there was a continuance because he expressed his innocence at sentencing, he didn't make a motion to withdraw his plea at that point?
Judge Larkin, as I answered Judge Ross, I don't think, as far as accuracy goes, anything past page 12 goes to accuracy. His failure to not later withdraw his plea does not go to the fact that his plea was inaccurate when it was accepted by the court.
And your position, I guess, implicitly, is that that would not constitute a waiver of a challenge to the guilty plea later on.
That would not. That would not constitute a waiver of that challenge.
Does the decision not to make a pre-sentencing motion to withdraw affect our analysis in terms of prejudice?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe it does.
Okay. If we were to agree with you, wouldn't Mr. Jones be placed in the same position he was pre-sentencing when the district court told him to meet with your attorney and decide if you want to make a motion to withdraw?
No, Your Honor. If you found in Mr. Jones' favor here, he would actually be in the position he was when he appeared at the plea hearing before his plea
right.
was accepted
or arguably
by the court.
When he's meeting with his attorney to decide whether or not to withdraw and decides he doesn't want to even make a motion. He would rather persist with the plea that he previously gave than even make a motion. So in some ways, he's in the same position at that point as well. I'm not sure I see the outcome being different.
The only reason I disagree, Judge Bryan, is because when he's appearing at sentencing, after his plea has been accepted, that would be analyzed under the fair and just standard. He does not have the absolute right to withdraw his plea at that point. He would have to make a compelling argument, the court would have to analyze the factors, and the court would have to come out on his side on that.
Your position now is that there's a manifest injustice, and so there's no need to ask him again whether he wants to withdraw his plea. This is effectively what he's doing through this appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would argue typically in these appeals, it's remanded to the district court, and the questions posed to the defendant. But if this court finds that the proper remedy is just to remand with instructions to withdraw, Mr. Jones would be open to that.
I mean, you're
as well.
Challenging the accuracy of the plea, so
that's correct.
It's not about motion to withdraw. I gather if you prevail on behalf of your client's plea is invalidated, and he stands facing all the charges that he faced the day that he made the comment that you're relying upon.
That's correct, Your Honor. I see I'm running low on time. Unless this court has any other questions for me, I'll just ask this court to reverse Mr. Jones' conviction and allow him to withdraw his plea.
I see Judge Bryan's hand was near his button. Do you have any further questions?
No, thank you.
None.
All right, we will move on, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. Michael Kinane, on behalf, certified student attorney, on behalf of the state of Minnesota, under the supervision of John Schmidt, who is present in the courtroom. This court should affirm the lower court because Jones admitted to each of the elements for third degree criminal sexual conduct and thus entered a guilty plea. Now, I would like to hit first on a question that Judge Bryan asked. How do we know what he meant when he used the word rape?
Can I pause you there before you head into that direction?
Sure thing.
Starting at the beginning of your brief, I saw a very detailed description of facts of a sexual assault. Are the facts as described in your detailed recitation on pages 2 through 3 of your brief relevant to the issue on appeal?
The state would acknowledge that the key relevant facts before the court are what the defendant admitted during the factual basis portion of the plea hearing. Those facts, as indicated in the brief, do come from the amended complaint. And I know that under the Rosendahl decision, we generally should not rely on that as part of the record. But the primary argument of the state relies solely on what was admitted to at the factual basis portion of the plea hearing.
So I'm not sure if I understand your answer. You said that the key relevant issues are those that he pleaded to. I wasn't sure whether you were answering my question yes or no, which was whether the facts recited, the detailed facts that you recited, are at all relevant.
The detailed facts are not relevant as they are only relevant as they are consistent with what was admitted to during the factual basis portion of the plea hearing.
I was surprised that the state led with those facts, therefore.
Yes, Your Honor. So, like I said, I want to touch on the question that Judge Bryan raised about how do we know what he meant when he used the word rape. And I agree with you, Your Honor, that it's confusing. At first, he says, I didn't rape my baby mama.
Before you proceed, I mean, what do you make of the fact that it's confusing? I mean, isn't it one of the reasons that we want stop and clarify to be the practice is so that we avoid that confusion? Couldn't it have been avoided if someone had just asked him, what do you mean?
I acknowledge that it may not have been best practices for the district court not to clarify, but there is no case law that means that what the district court's conduct was fatal to the plea. And I think...
I'm troubled by that. Defendant stands up and says, I didn't do it. We don't know what he means by I didn't do it. If he uses the term rape, we know that he's been accused of rape. Why don't we assume that the thing that he's saying he didn't do, the rape that he says he didn't do is the thing that he's talking about, that everybody's there to talk about. Why isn't that at least an assumption that triggers an inquiry to undo any question about what he means?
So I believe that, and I forget which one of your honors kind of brought it up, about the leading nature of the questions is an attempt to clarify what exactly that spontaneous comment meant. And I think that...
With all due respect, I have a hard time reading the leading questions as an attempt to clarify what he meant. It looks like an attempt to get him to admit that he committed the elements of rape as defined by statute. What is it in the language of the questions that would leave us with the impression that you want us to have, that this was an attempt to clarify what he meant by his assertion of innocence?
I think the key understanding about what was happening at the factual basis portion of the hearing is that the defendant was under oath, right? And we should understand that that means that he is going to be truthful when asked these questions during the factual basis portion of the plea hearing. And he did not deny any of the elements that were addressed during the factual basis portion
of
the plea.
Well, that was right after he said, okay, I didn't do it. But essentially, okay, let's go ahead with this. Let's keep it simple. Yes, I understand. And then boom, 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 boom. Yes, 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 done. Does the state acknowledge that we should at least be a little troubled by that?
I acknowledge that it's not what happened at the district court when the attorney was going over through the waiver of trial rights and the spontaneous comment was made, that it may not have been best practices what the district court did. But the conduct of the district court...
would have been best practices?
I think best practices may have been to clarify what he meant.
And how would the district court have done that? What would you say is the most appropriate way the district court could clarify what he meant?
You know, Your Honor, I'm not sure what exactly would be the best course of action. And I think the district court may be at a similar situation because we couldn't find any case law that really instructs what the district court should do there. And while opposing counsel does raise that perhaps the Denning case should instruct, the Denning case is limited to what happens at sentencing. And I think without instruction about how the district court should operate when basically shown with this kind of spontaneous comment, it cannot be fatal to the plea here. We have to be governed by what was admitted to during the factual basis.
It almost sounds like that's a reason not only to decide this issue, but to make sure the district court judges know exactly what they can do to clarify.
Your Honor, there are many other cases that have not nearly as fairly clean a record as this, in particular cases where the defendant makes a spontaneous comment like this during the...
I guess I was just responding to your last answer, which seemed to suggest that there was some confusion or some misunderstanding about what... You know, our case law isn't specific enough to instruct district court judges what to do when the situation arises. And that, to me, would suggest that we should be more specific. But I'm not sure I agree with the argument that we don't know what best practices are, or we can't know, or district court judge can't know. What was stopping the district court judge from saying, hold on a minute, talk to your attorney, just like it did at sentencing?
I can see that there is nothing stopping the district court from doing that. That was within the district court's discretion. But I think key to the inquiry here is that the district court was able to hear sufficient factual basis given on the record by, admitted to on the record by the defendant that established the elements of the charge here.
That seems to me a different, we were at first focused on whether or not this triggers a duty to clarify. And if so, did the district court's actions satisfy that responsibility? That's a different question than moving further on to what happened when the factual basis is being established. So I guess I'm still focused on that first part. Do you concede that this was enough to require stop and clarify?
I concede that, yeah, this was enough to stop and clarify, but I do not think that the district court was, it was is best practice to stop and clarify, but I do not contend that the district court was bound, had to stop and clarify.
What would, okay, so the defendant says, I didn't, he's accused of rape. He says, I didn't rape. What more do you believe, what more would the state say would be necessary to trigger the court's, not just best practices, as you put it, but duty to clarify? What more would have had to happen than the defendant saying, I didn't rape the alleged victim?
If he would have maybe said, I didn't use force on her, or I didn't penetrate her, kind of addressing, as the panel kind of discussed, rape is not a term that is in the statutes. It's third-degree criminal sexual conduct outlined by these elements.
So if this was a bank robbery and the defendant said, I did not rob that bank, your position would be the same because robbery has various elements. There's different ways to engage in robbery. Your position would be the same, that that's not enough of a denial to trigger a duty to clarify.
I think it's also important here that the statute doesn't use the word rape. If he would have said, I didn't commit third-degree criminal sexual conduct, or I didn't commit criminal sexual conduct, or even sexual misconduct, perhaps.
Do you agree that the term sexual misconduct or criminal sexual conduct is the statutory verbiage for the common term rape?
Perhaps. I think there are... Rape is a very old word. There are lots of different connotations and meaning that have been put to the word.
So why wouldn't, if that's so, a defendant who's not versed in the statutory language but is accused of criminal sexual conduct, why wouldn't we construe that individual's denial of rape when charged with criminal sexual conduct to mean I didn't commit criminal sexual conduct?
I think key here is, again, is that while the court may have, it may have been best practices to clarify what that meant, he did not provide any kind of antithetical response later when actually covering the factual.
Again, that's a different argument. That's whether it was clarified, not whether there was a duty and what triggers that duty, right? So again, staying on that point, would it be different if he said, I didn't do it, and just said it?
I still believe that while...
What if you said, I'm not guilty?
I think I'm not guilty might have some different connotation or different consequences and implications because guilty is a term of art. It has a legal meaning, and rape does not have a legal meaning. We have specific...
Rape doesn't have a legal meaning unless we acknowledge what you've acknowledged, which is that the term rape is a general term that individuals use in place of the statutory term, or vice versa. The statutory term, criminal sexual conduct, is in place of what is commonly, historically, referred to as rape. I mean, I know that I've used the term, even in opinions that are written by the court. This court has used the term rape in cases as a substitute for criminal sexual conduct. You know that, right? I mean,
Yes.
So why wouldn't we assume that's exactly what this individual was saying?
I can see that even if the court interpreted, as you said, that rape is equivalent to what he was charged with, because the court did not, because he did not deny or raise the comment again during the factual basis portion of the plea hearing, which is the most important part.
We're going back to Judge Bryan's focus on the duty here. So if in this case, Mr. Jones had said, instead of I did not rape the victim, Mr. Jones said, I did not commit criminal sexual conduct against the victim, would that have been enough to trigger the court's duty?
I believe so, but I think the court's duty might have been addressed during the factual basis portion of the plea hearing. because it heard, it didn't hear the spontaneous comment again. It didn't hear a denial of any of...
It's certainly so that this court has never reversed a guilty plea simply because of leading questions. But I don't know that your brief, at least for me, adequately addresses the combination here. You've got leading questions only after a defendant says, I did not commit rape. So discuss the leading questions and the propriety or impropriety of using leading questions in that context.
So I think key here to what leading questions serve a purpose for during the factual basis portion of a plea hearing is to ensure that the defendant does not plead more than what they are charged with, to basically have very narrow guidelines for what the defendant is admitting to on the record and because of the consequences that those admissions have. So I think that while the combination of the spontaneous comment with the leading questions, it's, again, not best practices and is disfavored, but I do not believe that the leading questions serve the purpose that they were intended to serve there, which was to prevent him. Jones was charged with multiple other counts and also had lots of other cases that were dismissed because of this plea agreement. And so the leading questions, the leading nature of the questions, was able to prevent him from admitting to any other conduct that might have resulted in consequences with those charges and other cases. I see that my time is up, and I would just ask that because Jones admitted to all the elements of third-degree criminal sexual assault, that he used force, that he had sexual intercourse with the victim despite not consenting, and that he penetrated her vagina, that the court, that his plea was accurate, and that this court affirmed the lower court.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, any rebuttal?
There's 3 points that I'd like to make on rebuttal. The first is during my opening remarks, I said that Mr. Jones was asking this court to allow him to withdraw a plea that the district court was not permitted to accept. What I meant when I said the district court wasn't permitted to accept this plea, there's two criminal rules of criminal procedure, 1501 subdivision 1-7 and 1501 subdivision 1-8. The first says that the court must inquire into whether the defendant makes any claim of innocence. Here, I would argue there is a clear assertion of innocence here, and the district court was obligated to follow up on that. So I would disagree that that district courts need more guidance. I think it's very clear. The rules say you have to follow up on assertions of innocence.
Well, I mean, the argument is by the state that that's essentially what happened with the leading questions. And I think that was the basis for the concern that there's not enough guidance if the district court believes that leading questions, as occurred here, would clarify that your client didn't really mean that he's challenging any one of the actual elements. That's enough of an inquiry, whether it's the court or counsel. What's your position on that?
So I take your point, Judge Ross, but the language of the rule is very clear. It says the court, not the court or defense counsel or one of the parties. The court must follow up on assertions of innocence. The actual language is the court has to ask the defendant if they're making any claim. We didn't get there. Mr. Jones just shouted it out.
The attorney follows up. Does the court also have to follow up, or is reversible?
I would argue under this rule, the court has to follow up. The other rule is that the defendant...
Under the rule, the court has to follow up, but assume that's so, that the court errs by failing to follow up under the rule. But you still get into the harmless error issue. Judge Bryan makes a point. If counsel does... and elicits the answer that the court would have elicited, then how is the error prejudicial?
So I think we would then end up with like this case in Mikulak where the court held that you have to either correct or withdraw. I think that then becomes the focus. Did the defendant sufficiently correct, or did they expressly withdraw their prior assertion of innocence? The other rule of criminal procedure that I wanted to mention is 1501 subdivision 1-8, which says that the defendant must state the factual basis for the plea. Not his attorney, not the court, not the prosecutor, the defendant. And here, the only thing that Mr. Jones said during this plea hearing, besides I'm innocent, is yes.
Right, but on that issue, you've acknowledged, I mean, there are multitudes of cases where we say, where the Supreme Court has said, you know, it's leading questions aren't favored. There's almost an equal number of cases where the plea is nevertheless affirmed.
So Judge Ross, I'd have 2 points. This court's gone further than just saying they're not favored. They are specifically disfavored. And this court has held that you should be particularly wary of accepting a plea made by leading questions.
Right, that's my point. We've said that many times.
Yes.
And we've affirmed many times, nevertheless.
I'm not aware of any case by this court or the Supreme Court where a defendant's asserted their innocence, followed that up with leading questions, and this court has affirmed or reversed. I don't think those facts exist in any case. The second point I wanted to make is the district court knew what to do. Its duty is clear. And it did so at the sentencing hearing. And Judge Ross, I know you and I talked about the sentencing hearing in this case. What I want to point out is that the state waffles back and forth a little bit about what would require the district court to do a follow-up, how clear Mr. Jones needed to be to trigger a follow-up. But in their brief on page 10, talking about the assertion of innocence at sentencing, the state says, the district court, however, did not ignore the statement and proceed with sentencing. To do so without giving defense counsel time to confer with the defendant would have been improper. The assertion at sentencing, I would argue, is less clear than the assertion at the plea hearing. And the district court had the same obligation it had at sentencing, to follow up or give Mr. Jones time with defense counsel. The third point I wanted to make is up here, the state said that the leading questions serve their purpose. Leading questions outside of a cross-examination during trial do not serve a purpose. Leading questions do not serve a purpose in a factual basis. And this court has been very clear about that. And Judge Ross, I take your point. This court has not reversed solely on those grounds.
Well, we haven't reversed solely on those grounds because they do serve a purpose. They get the information out that, did you do X? Yes. Did you do it in this way? Yes. It's disfavored, but it gets the information out. I mean, it does serve a purpose. Otherwise, why would we be affirming guilty verdicts?
Perhaps this court should not affirm this guilty verdict.
No, I understand that's your point, but I'm not sure I agree that they don't serve a purpose. I agree. Obviously, they're disfavored.
Yeah.
I think that's clear in the law.
I see I'm out of time. I'll just conclude by saying I would encourage this court to consider both this assertion of innocence along with the leading questions in this case in finding that the plea was inaccurately entered. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Kinane. Very well done. You know, I think we've been here before with you. This is not your first time, correct?
This is my first time arguing for the court.
I thought you've been here before.
No, I just sat in the gallery.
Well, excellent job. I'm sure you'll get a great grade for your performance today. You've served your client very well, as has Mr. Nelson. We appreciate your briefs. We appreciate your oral arguments. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.